World Service, Bush House, The Strand, London, WC2B, 4PH in the United Kingdom. Before that, we heard English language programming from Radio Sweden. You can write to them at Radio Sweden, S105, Stockholm, Sweden. News is next on CBC Radio 1.
Here is the CBC Hourly News. I'm Jim Martin. Another Ontario healthcare worker died from SARS yesterday. A 58-year-old nurse was infected in the first wave of SARS. She worked at the William Osler Health Center. She was the second health worker to die from severe acute respiratory syndrome. The first death of a healthcare worker came late last month when a North York General Hospital nurse died. 51-year-old Nelia LaRosa and 15 other nurses were infected in mid-May during the second outbreak. 41 people have now died in Ontario of SARS or complications from SARS. 16 other SARS patients remain in Toronto hospitals. A candlelight vigil was held in downtown Montreal last night to celebrate the life of an Iranian-born photojournalist who died while in the custody of Iranian authorities. There are suspicions Zehra Kazemi died of head injuries suffered in a beating by police. She was arrested while covering student demonstrations. Her son, Stéphane Hachemi, wants her body returned to Canada for an autopsy. Reporter Marie-Claire Lemieux is at the vigil. She tells us there are conflicting stories from Iranian officials.
Iranian officials first said she had a brain seizure. Then a few days ago, Iran's vice president said she had been beaten. And the version of events has changed again since. The Iranian deputy interior minister says Kazemi's death may have been the result of a fall. So Kazemi's son, Stéphane Hachemi, says it's now time Canada asks Iran for the truth about his mother's death. He says he wants an autopsy to be performed on his mother's body, and he says it's not too late. Stéphane Hachemi says he's spoken with his grandmother who lives in Iran, and he says she's seen her daughter in the forensic department. So the body has not been buried yet.
Marie-Claude Lemieux, the Canadian ambassador to Iran, told reporters this week he has demanded an investigation. Two more American soldiers have been killed and a third wounded when their convoy was struck by rocket-propelled grenades and gunshots. Today's attack was in the northern part of the country. The deaths bring to 151 the number of American soldiers killed in action since the start of the war in March. British police have confirmed that a body found yesterday is that of a missing British scientist linked to the intelligence controversy over Iraq. Police say David Kelly's death was apparently by suicide. Acting Superintendent David Purnell is a police spokesman.
And I can confirm that the body at Tarradown Hill that was found yesterday at 9:20 a.m. has been formally identified as Dr. David Kelly, age 59. The post-mortem has revealed that the cause of death was hemorrhaging from a wound to his left wrist. The injury is consistent with having been caused by a bladed object. Whilst our inquiries are continuing, there is no indication at this stage of any other party being involved.
The British government has called an independent judicial inquiry into the circumstances surrounding the death. Embattled Liberian President Charles Taylor has vowed to fight to the last man as rebels continue their advance on the capital, Monrovia. He also reiterated his pledge to step down and accept asylum in Nigeria, but only after multinational peacekeeping forces arrive in sufficient numbers. Jason Bobian reports from the capital.
In an address broadcast on state-run radio, Liberian President Charles Taylor attacked U.S. President George Bush, accusing Mr. Bush of undermining his authority. As gunfire ripped through Monrovia and mortars exploded around the city, Taylor said the U.S. has blood on its hands for calling for his immediate resignation. The Liberian president said he's willing to step down, but not until a sufficient number of international peacekeepers arrive.
I am here with you. I will not leave you. This revolution is our lives. And I can say to you, my life depends on you, and your lives depend on me.
Rebels pushed deep into Monrovia in a breach of the ceasefire agreement and their most aggressive offensive to date.
National Public Radio's Jason Bobian in Monrovia. And police in Toronto now say it could be midweek before they recover the body of a Chicago lawyer whose plane crashed into Lake Ontario 12 days ago. The barges needed to raise the sunken plane have not yet arrived. And that's the CBC News.
Hello and welcome to CBC Radio Overnight. I'm Judy Madryn. We continue to bring you CBC News on the Hour, as well as information programming from global public broadcasters. Now, we present programming from the English language service of Radio Deutsche Welle in Germany. At the end of the hour, I'll provide you with their mailing address. This is CBC Radio 1.
DW Radio. Inside Europe.
Hello and welcome to Inside Europe. I'm Helen Sini in Cologne. On today's program, Iraq's dispossessed Jews seek compensation for past wrongs.
They wrote a letter to me, the government, saying, unless you return to stay in Iraq, you will lose your citizenship and all your assets will be confiscated. And I decided that I would rather lose all my assets than go back to Iraq and be in the hands of that dictatorship.
Also on Inside Europe, should EU citizens have the right to vote on the new European constitution? And are pub toilets in Prague a health hazard? Those stories and more coming up on the programme. Last week, the draft constitution for the European Union was approved by the convention which drew it up. And now it's the turn of individual governments to discuss its merits and weaknesses. The draft constitution contains articles ranging from the EU's flag and anthem to a proposal for a new EU foreign minister and president. But should it be introduced without asking the people? No, according to Jens Peter Bonder, a member of the convention and an MEP. He, along with the majority of the convention, has called on EU members to hold referendums on the draft constitution.
I did that together with half of the members of the convention, honest federalists who are in favor of a strong European nation state, and honest EU critics who oppose it. We agree that our disagreements shall be solved by the peoples of Europe in referendums. In some countries it can be binding referendums, in some it can be voluntary, as in Germany, where referendum is not a part of the constitution.
But members of the convention, such as yourself, have spent more than 16 months thrashing out the details of the constitution, and it is a compromise constitution. Isn't there a danger that referendums could render all that work null and void?
It's a compromise done in Brussels by those meeting in Brussels, but it's not a compromise with the peoples of Europe. They haven't honestly been questioned. And those who voted no in referendums for the Nice Treaty, to the Nice Treaty in Ireland, that was a majority of the Irish citizens, they were not represented in the convention at all, only their substitute member. Those who voted no to the Maastricht Treaty in France, it was 49%, they were not represented even with a substitute member. So the representation in the convention was not a representative forum for Europe, and therefore I hope that a referendum in one of the countries where there will be a referendum will reject this draft constitution and ask the governments of Europe to prepare another text. Talk with the peoples of Europe before they present what they call a compromise. It's certainly not a compromise with me.
What are your chief reservations regarding the constitution?
I think a constitution is a very good idea to have for a nation state. But between nation states, you should not have a constitution. There you should have an international treaty between sovereign nation states. And then we should share in common those areas for legislation which we can't decide efficiently on our own. Cross-frontier issues like pollution in the air, pollution in the sea, taxation of multinational companies. There are areas you can't reach from a national parliament, and then it makes sense to have cross-frontier legislation. My idea is that the EU should focus on those cross-frontier issues we can't deal with in the national parliaments. Then we have nothing to lose, but then we could add to the democracies of Europe, add real influence. Now the constitution takes away the democracy as established in most European nation states.
If we get back to the idea of a referendum, do voters in the various EU states know enough about the constitution? Do they understand what it means for them personally?
It's what a referendum referendum is about. It's a learning process. If you have referendums, then people read, and often ordinary citizens read much more than ministers ever did on such texts. So they will prepare themselves, they are adult, and then they will take a responsible decision. We have a lot of experience in referendums in Denmark, and I can't see any other way of solving such constitutional issues.
When the EU expands next year, it'll have 25 members. If referendums were to take place in each of those countries, and one country, let's say Malta, voted against the constitution, what effect would that have?
I think if it was only one country having a referendum and they voted no, then I think we should try to test this constitution in other countries as well. When Ireland voted no to the Nice Treaty, it was not respected. They were simply asked to vote a second time. It would have been much more wise to ask people in other parts of Europe if they would agree in the constitution, or at the time, the treaty. I think if 24 member states vote yes for a constitution and one member state votes no, in referendums where people have got the text in front of them, where there have been an enlightened debate, and you then approve the constitution in the 24 countries out of the 25, then I think we will have to negotiate a deal with country number 25. But if there's only a referendum in one country and they vote no, then I think we should respect that.
Of course, when the euro was adopted as the single currency, there were many countries which didn't put that decision to a referendum, so why should it be...
And honestly, if it had been put to a referendum, for instance in Germany, maybe 70% of the electorate in Germany would have voted no for that euro. And such important decisions shall not be taken by the politicians. It shall be taken by the peoples of Europe, and the Germans should certainly have been asked. And now we have all the trouble with the euro because it doesn't work. And it was not difficult to force the I wrote a book about it. Several others did that as well. So we could have avoided a lot of problems by having had referendums about the EMU at the time.
If the constitution is adopted the way it stands, what practical effect will it have on the daily lives of EU citizens?
It will move most decisions from the capitals to Brussels. It will take away the say of the citizens on daily topics, social policy, workforce policy. Most policies will simply be moved from the nation states to Brussels, where 13 of the 25 member states can decide against 12 member states. That's what is called qualified majority vote. 13 of the 25 member states can outvote, downvote 12 member states. It means that the electorates in 12 member states can lose their influence. And then they can go for elections next time, but they can never amend the law. And they cannot appoint a government. They cannot elect a government. So this constitution is missing the most central point in all democratic constitutions, democracy. There is no power to the citizens, with the electorates, in this draft EU constitution.
Jens Peter Bonder, a member of the European Convention, speaking from Copenhagen. The list of Iraq's creditors gets longer every day. The country is not only buckling under huge debts run up while Saddam Hussein was in power, it also faces massive bills for the war damage that Saddam's regime caused during the invasion of Kuwait. And now another group of claimants has joined the ever-lengthening queue. Thousands of Iraqi Jews, expelled and dispossessed by the old regime, are seeking compensation. Stephen Beard has been meeting some of these Iraqi Jewish exiles in London.
Every week, a small group of Iraqi Jewish musicians gathers in London to rehearse and perform. They're celebrating an ancient culture. Jews have lived in what is now called Iraq for more than 2.5 millennia. Many of the 7,000 Iraqi Jews who now live in exile in London, many of them hounded out of their country by Saddam Hussein, are determined that their heritage should not be forgotten.
I will not allow our contribution to be expunged from the history of the Middle East. We were there, our ancestors were there, and we should be recognized as such.
Edwin Shuker was 16 when he and his family fled Iraq in the early 1970s. They left the country after several years of persecution of the Jews by Saddam's regime.
We were not allowed to work. We were not allowed to sell our property. We were not even allowed to draw from the money in our banks, let alone working or importing or exporting. All this were cancelled. You were not allowed to go to higher education. You were not allowed to travel outside a 10-kilometer radius. We had the telephones taken out of from our homes. And worst of all, we were ready to give and leave every single thing we've got just to walk out of that place with our own clothes.
Thousands of Iraqi Jews in Europe, the US and Israel are now demanding compensation for the property they left behind when they fled Iraq. Most of the exiles, like George High, left the country empty-handed.
I left everything behind, my business, our farms, our house.
George, now a diamond merchant in London's Hatton Garden, wants reparation from Iraq.
They're not poor country. Iraq is a very rich country. They must give to citizens who struggled all their life. They built Iraq. The Jews built Iraq. All our life, they took it away.
Even the richest of London's Iraqi Jews support the call for compensation. Naim Dangour has made a huge fortune in the British property market. But 40 years ago, he was forced to abandon two factories, several houses, and a block of flats in Iraq. He was on business in London when he received a threatening message from the government in Baghdad.
They wrote a letter to me, the government, saying, unless you return to stay in Iraq, you will lose your citizenship and all your assets will be confiscated. And I decided that I would rather lose all my assets than go back to Iraq and be in the hands of that dictatorship.
He says that now Iraq has been liberated, it should make amends for his lost property. And he says it could be done painlessly.
We would be happy to receive bonds. That's to say, we don't need to have cash, all of us. So the compensation would be spread over a period of time.
Naim Dangour has a bolder vision. He would like to see all Iraq's Jews return to their homeland and rebuild it along with their Arab fellow countrymen.
I don't dread the thought of going back. On the contrary, we were born there and we feel we are a product of that country.
Edwin Shuker, who's lived more than two-thirds of his life in Britain, does not himself intend to return and settle in Iraq, but he says other Iraqi Jews should be free to do so. He has a simple message for all Iraqi Arabs.
I want them to know that we were their partners. I want them to know that we've built the country. I want them to know that we are stakeholder and shareholder in Iraq as much as any other Muslim or Christian who live abroad and who long to be back and who long to keep the connection.
The word from Baghdad is not encouraging. Faced with more than $300 billion of debt and war reparation claims, Iraq is unlikely to consider compensation for the Jews a high priority, according to groups involved in the new interim administration. And given the deep hostility toward Israel throughout the Arab world, Iraqi Jews who do return should not expect a friendly reception. Stephen Beard, DW Radio, London.
And I'm Helen Sini in Cologne. You're listening to Inside Europe. The Czechs are a nation of beer drinkers, and there are two distinctly different types of pubs in the country. There are the swanky upmarket bars, which cater for tourists and the more discerning locals, and the more traditional Czech boozer. That second variety could be under threat as new strict hygiene rules come into force. From Prague, Rob Cameron has this report.
Lidičky, já mám rád pivo.
Já taky.
Za pivo.
Dismiss all images of burnished mahogany chairs and roaring open fires. The traditional Czech pub in its purest form is a simple, rough-and-ready affair. Men in blue overalls sitting around formica tables, sinking pints of frothy lager in a fug of cigarette smoke. The decor usually consists of plastic pot plants and a slot machine, maybe a topless calendar on the wall. I'm not complaining. The Czech pub experience, after all, provides the quickest, easiest and cheapest way of tasting the best beer in the world. But one part of this experience is usually best avoided. In 10 months' time, the Czech Republic joins the European Union. Many standards of life in this country already compare favourably to that of the EU. Czech pub toilets are not among them. This week, the country introduced new strict hygiene rules for pubs and restaurants, and many of those rules are revolutionary. Hot running water in the washrooms, wow! Paper towels next to the sink instead of a single soggy rag hanging from a nail. But many pub owners are not ready for the new toilet rules.
Paper towels is one thing, but any more than that, and little pubs like this one will simply go out of business. We're ready to buy the paper towels, that's no problem. But hot running water in the toilets? I don't think so. We haven't even worked out how much it will cost, but it's definitely a huge amount of money.
That financial excuse doesn't wash with Prague's chief hygiene officer, Vladimir Polanecki.
Look, paper towels and hot water in the toilets are completely normal in every toilet in Western Europe. The new rules mean that pubs and restaurants will have to install hot running water, controlled by a tap that you can operate without touching. That tap costs about 6,000 crowns, which is around $200. 6,000 crowns is not going to ruin any pub in this country.
Experts say only one pub in 10 conforms to the new hygiene regulations, and meeting them will be costly. That's because we're not just talking toilets. There are also strict new rules on storing and reheating food, spelling an end to goulash sitting on the stove all day, for one thing. Is this the end of the traditional Czech pub, as one paper asked this week? Well, probably not. But the times and the toilets are a-changing.
Rob Cameron reporting from Prague. Another chance to enter our monthly quizzes coming up. First, though, the winners from last month. The question related to Latin lover Giacomo Casanova and which country he introduced the lottery to. Well, the answer is France. Congratulations to Dilesh Pereira in Badulla, Sri Lanka, Andres Zidler in Bialystok, Poland, Felix Rees in Antarctica, Tim Young in Brisbane, Australia, and the Hesse family in Alberta, Canada. Your prizes are on their way to you. If you weren't a winner, not to worry. Here's another chance to take part in this month's quiz. This month, the Tour de France is celebrating its 100th birthday. It's a landmark competition in the cycling world and grueling to say the least. The winner, who takes the coveted yellow jersey, will have cycled over 3,400 kilometres. The jerseys are also awarded for other achievements during the race. For example, a green jersey is awarded to the best sprinter. We want you to tell us who receives the red polka dot jersey. You can email your answer to us. The address is europe@dwworld.de. That's europe@dwworld.de. Or simply write to us via snail mail at Inside Europe, European Desk, Deutsche Welle, Cologne, Germany. Perhaps you can also tell us on which station you received the programme. We have 5 Deutsche Welle t-shirts to give away and will announce the winners in mid-August. The question again, what is the red polka dot jersey awarded for in the Tour de France cycling race? Looking forward to hearing from you. Since the collapse of the Soviet Union in 1991, Russian society has gone through some wrenching changes, especially the capital Moscow. The bleakness and grey monotony of the Soviet era has given way to glitzy neon and flashy flamboyance. The socialist planned economy was stampeded by Russia's own brand of cowboy capitalism, where a few mostly unscrupulous business people made millions, while many others fell through a state safety net left in tatters. It's been a dizzying decade for Russia, and the country is still somewhat unsure about its bearings. Reporter Kyle James travelled to Moscow recently to see how society has evolved 12 years after Marx and Lenin officially lost their standing. He left the city with these impressions.
I wasn't sure what to expect from Moscow these days. Having thrown off the yoke of communism, I wanted to see how this city that I still associated with breadlines and Brezhnev was faring. I soon found out that the heart of Mother Russia has been pumped full of adrenaline over the past 12 years and is nothing like it was before. The avenues in the city center once probably saw more military reviews than automobiles. Today, they're choked with traffic. Its human population is bounding as well. The impoverished countryside is emptying out as people look to earn a living in the city. You feel it, too, and nowhere more acutely than in the city's famed subway system. I was looking forward to seeing the Stalinist-era prestige project and its famous station interiors with marble faces and gilded works of art. Entering one station, I found myself in a rotunda featuring a mosaic of Lenin leading happy collective farmers to a socialist utopia, jumping on the high-speed escalators that whisk passengers down many, many feet underground. I passed the symbols of the new Russia, ads for cars, clothes, and shampoo. Still, there's little time to enjoy the juxtaposition, since doing any kind of stopping, even to figure out a sign in the Cyrillic alphabet, can be hazardous to your health. One statistic says 9 million passengers ride the trains every day. But for those with claustrophobia, I wouldn't recommend it. I preferred taking the boat and getting a tour on the Moscow River. From there, you get an interesting view of the city's history and its evolving mentality, reflected in its architecture. There are the Orthodox churches, some dating from the Middle Ages, whose brightly colored onion domes dot the cityscape. Then Stalin came to power and brought grandiosity with him. His so-called Seven Sisters skyscrapers look like giant stone wedding cakes. Later Soviet architecture can be summed up in one word, dour. Now it's New Russia's turn, and the city is peppered with buildings that are supposed to reflect Moscow's vibrancy and modernity. What you get instead is pure kitsch. The apex of it all has to be a giant statue of Peter the Great on the banks of the river. It's twice the height of the Statue of Liberty and features Peter standing astride a ship sailing to parts unknown. Many people wish it'd literally sail away. It's so bad that one group tried to blow it up, and it's under 24-hour guard today. Some of the people financing these monstrosities made their fortunes in, well, less than legal ways. Much has been made of the Russian mafia, but I was told not to worry. I was warned, however, to avoid a certain sushi place down the road, since a contract killing had taken place there a week earlier. You do see people that make you wonder, like the men sporting dark sunglasses and leather jackets. They usually have bleach blonde trophy girlfriends on their arms and never wait in airport lines. On one of my last days there, I was walking in an area that's become home to many of the nouveau riche. Suddenly, three men, all dressed in black pants and black shirts, left a building I was in front of and walked hurriedly over to an unmarked van. They opened the side door, which revealed yet another door, this one black and reinforced-looking. It opened, and they hopped in as the van sped off. For my part, I just kept walking, with visions of hitmen and oil tycoon kidnappings dancing in my head.
Kyle James, who's now back home in Berlin.
dwworld.de, Deutsche Welle's internet website. We bring you news and views from a European perspective. You'll find information about current affairs, business and economics, culture and lifestyle. You can even learn German with our online German courses. And, of course, we bring you the latest program details for DWTV and DW Radio. Deutsche Welle on the Internet at dwworld.de.
And I'm Helen Sini in Cologne. You're listening to Inside Europe. is Inside Europe, and I'm Helen Sini in Cologne. In the next half hour, has independence worsened the plight of Armenia's street children?
I would say it's a phenomenon within the last 5-6 years. You would never see children begging on the street during the Soviet period or even the first years of independence. It's a question of survival. You know, if they're not on the street, they have no food to eat. It hurts me to see that the government has not adopted proper regulations and laws and has not provided support for these families.
Also on Inside Europe, allegations of mass rape by British soldiers in Kenya. Young people in Paris get a taste of local politics and why up-and-coming conductors flock to Stuttgart. Stay tuned for those stories and more. Amnesty International is demanding an independent inquiry into allegations that British soldiers have raped at least 650 women in Kenya. The alleged rapes took place over a period of 30 years by soldiers sent there on military exercises. Amnesty says attempts to investigate these allegations have run into a wall of silence and that the British Army had turned a blind eye to the rape claims. Elisa Dupieri is with Amnesty International.
Well, we wrote to the Ministry of Defense in May while we were researching the allegations, and we received a reply in which they confirmed that they have initiated a military police investigation into, we understand, some 16 allegations. And that is all they are prepared to say at the moment. We are not aware of any other state public statement they have made.
We're talking about a 30-year period here. Is there evidence that the Ministry of Defense was aware of these rape allegations early on?
Well, we had access to some documentary evidence that seems to indicate that British Army officials were indeed aware of these, of some of these allegations as early as 1977. And there are minutes of a meeting that occurred in 1983, to which members of the UK Army participated and where some allegations were discussed.
Now, legal action has been taken on behalf of these women by a solicitor, Martin Day. He started investigating these claims 6 months ago. What chance do these women have of successfully suing the British government, do you think?
Martin Day is representing the women and is seeking reparation, redress. This is not a criminal kind of investigation that he is pursuing. It is not for us to say how good their chances are, but we are aware that there is significant documentary evidence that some of these women were examined by doctors and that the diagnosis indicated that they were raped. In some cases, it indicated that they were raped by white soldiers. Some women went to the police in Kenya and reported that they were raped. So there are records that indicate that these allegations are corroborated. So on the basis of this, we think that quite a strong case can be built.
What effect have these alleged rapes had on the women themselves in Kenya, in these very small communities there?
Well, it had a terrible effect. I was really touched when I went to talk to some of these women. And for them, it's been really their lives were completely shattered after the alleged attacks took place, because they also live in communities where rape is a taboo. And so after the rape, they had to endure the physical suffering following from the rape. Some were pregnant and miscarried. Some indeed got pregnant as a result of the rape, they allege. And as a result, they were marginalized by their communities because they were regarded as prostitutes, as loose. After the rape, they were not treated as members of the community as they were before. Some, for example, complained that people were not talking to them anymore in the same way. They couldn't participate at celebrations of the community. Husbands were beating them or referring to the rape every time there is they are arguing about something, that the rape comes up as if it was the women's fault. So it was really a dreadful impact that it had on their lives.
Were they frightened about speaking out against the British Army?
They were frightened about saying that they had been raped by white men. Actually, acknowledging it in front of the community, knowing that they would have to overcome also the reaction of their communities, was really dreadful for them. It was the rape itself, not as much as the fact that it came from British soldiers.
Well, are the Kenyan authorities putting pressure on the British government to respond to these claims?
We have written to the Kenyan authorities, but as far as I know, we haven't received a reply yet. We wrote in June. We understand that they are liaising with the Royal Military Police team, which is investigating the claims.
Now, the Ministry of Defence has prosecuted British soldiers stationed in Cyprus and also Germany for rape. So why the lack of response regarding these claims?
It is really astonishing if we think that it may have gone on for something like three decades. I think that what could have contributed is the fact that these are communities that live in very remote areas, and these communities are vulnerable from many point of views. The women are in many cases illiterate. They are extremely poor. They are shepherds communities. Police stations are far away. They don't have the money. They have to pay to actually have access to medical treatment. And they didn't, somehow we think that they could have perceived as particularly vulnerable and therefore easy prey.
Amnesty International's Elisa De Pierri speaking there from London. In a way, most democracies aren't really fully democratic, at least not for those under voting age. Some countries have a minimum voting age of 15, but in most places you have to be 18 to vote, and in others at least 21 to have your say. But young people in Paris are now being given the chance to participate in politics in a new way. The city government has set up youth councils, which allow teenagers and young adults to vote on issues concerning city life. Geneviève Auger has more from Paris.
It's a beautiful Saturday afternoon on the banks of Paris's Canal Saint-Martin. The spring weather has brought out the boating crowd on the narrow city canal. But not everyone is out basking in the warm weather. About 30 young people, ages 13 to 25, will be spending this Saturday afternoon indoors, discussing politics. These young people are attending the third plenary session of one of Paris's youth councils. This is the council for Paris's 10th arrondissement, one of the most culturally diverse neighborhoods in the city. The crowd reflects the diversity, both in terms of age and ethnic origin. The youngest participant is 13. I asked Benjamin Pasquali, a law student and council member, what goes on at these meetings.
We talk about our project. For example, we have a wall painting project. Another project is a festival for a cinema about citizenship. Another one for a playground, to open playground in the hill. And we try to contact people who can help us, all the social actors of the city.
Participants are all volunteers. They are people who have signed up to participate because they were interested in the political process. You might think some kids are pushed into doing this by their parents. Think again. Flora Barki appears to be a quiet teenager. Don't let appearances deceive you, though. She joined the council when she was only 14. She's now 15, and she says her participation is entirely her idea.
I heard about this in the mail. I found it interesting, and when I came to check it out, I found there was a really good atmosphere here, so I wanted to participate. It was mostly my initiative because my mum wanted to throw the paper away, so I got the paper out of the garbage and called to see how I could take part.
Participants sit at tables arranged in a U-shape in the wedding room of the local city hall. Wall-sized frescoes dating from the 19th century adorn the walls of this elegant room. Each council member has a microphone and a pad of paper, giving the meeting an air of formality.
Je vais rapporter l'avancée, puisqu'André n'est pas là, l'avancée des travaux sur le groupe Terrain de Sport.
Though some of the participants begin speaking with some hesitation, they seem to get used to it rather quickly. They just get down to business. They go through the agenda and report to the rest of the council what each of the working groups has been up to. The mood is relaxed, but participants give the impression they take their work here very seriously. So much so that I wondered whether these young people are really typical of the people their age. I asked Tony Dreyfus, the mayor of the 10th arrondissement and a former student activist himself, what he thought.
People who get involved are necessarily the most serious because it involves some sacrifices. Look at today. It is a beautiful day. Wouldn't it be more pleasant to take a walk on the banks of the Canal Saint-Martin or to play some football? Instead, they are spending their day in a room. So these are the most serious people. But you can hope that the more serious youth will attract some less serious ones and that in the end they will generate interest for the project they are working on.
The role of the council is strictly consultative. It gives its opinions on local issues which the real elected councillors can choose to follow or not.
Voilà, donc qui accepte, c'est dans ce sens-là, qui accepte ce logo.
But the Youth Council does vote on issues that they control, like the plan to launch a small magazine aimed at young people in the district.
Très bien, bon ben, presque à l'unanimité. C'est bon, qui sont les personnes contre? Oui, qui s'abstient?
Local youth councils have generated so much grassroots interest that Paris is in the process of creating a youth council for the entire city. A council that would bring together representatives from all the youth councils in all the neighborhoods that make up the city. A chance for the country's future politicians and activists to get even more involved in the body politic. Because for these motivated youths, being involved has nothing to do with age. They believe it's never too early to take an active part in the political process. Geneviève Auger, DW Radio, Paris.
Having more say in decision-making is something that many young people in Armenia can only dream about. In fact, an increasing number of kids there have less and less control over their own lives. Armenians went to the polls earlier this year for presidential elections. The two candidates hoping to lead the country for the next 5 years vied with each other as to how they would boost the economy, improve foreign relations, and put Armenia on the international stage. But neither said anything about the growing problem of children forced to live and sleep on the streets. Governments may come and go, but Armenia's street children remain, as Chloe Arnold has been finding out.
It's 7 o'clock in the capital, Yerevan, and Armenia's moneyed elite has just sat down to a cabaret at the Chamber Theatre. The cloakroom attendant is hanging row upon row of sleek ladies' jackets, and a group of men in designer suits has ordered 6 bottles of champagne for the interval. Outside, 2 small boys are selling tiny bunches of purple wild flowers from a plastic tray. It's cold and wet, and they're clinging to each other to keep warm.
For many years, as my husband and I were going to theater or to a restaurant and coming out late at night, we would see children begging on the street and approaching us with flowers or asking for money. And we had a very guilty feeling because we would start calculating how much money we had just spent on our own pleasure and thinking the money we spent on the theater and on dinner would feed a whole family for a week.
And so 3 years ago, Armineh Hovhannisyan set up a refuge for Yerevan's street children. She called it Oran, the Armenian word for haven.
So very quickly, people heard about it, relatives, friends, and people started making donations. And as children started hearing about Oran, they came to us knocking on our door. And so Orang grew, and now we have 50 children.
My name is Artur Sukyasyan, and I'm 17 years old. It was the 7th of September, and Mrs. Ame Ne came up to me. I won't deny it, I was selling flowers in the street. I went up to her and asked her if she wanted to buy some flowers. She asked me whether I'd heard of Oran, whether I wanted to come, and I've been coming ever since. I don't sell flowers anymore.
All over Armenia, children forced to live on the streets pick wild flowers, tie them into posies no bigger than a man's hand, and sell them to anyone they can. Artur's story is similar to hundreds of other children's, left to fend for themselves because their parents can't afford to look after them.
I stopped going to school when I was 11 years old. I couldn't read or write until they taught me at Oran. There used to be 6 children in my family, but 4 died when they were young. My father was a violent man, and he used to beat my mother up. She also had a number of miscarriages. My father went to Moscow in 1992. He was trying to earn money so that he could buy a bigger flat, but he never came back. My mother was born handicapped. One of her legs doesn't work. She doesn't have a job, that's why I left school.
Once dubbed the Soviet Silicon Valley, Armenia used to be one of the most prosperous of the former Soviet republics. But since it gained its independence 12 years ago, factories and enterprises have closed down, and almost a third of the population, or 1 million people, has left the country for a better life abroad. Unemployment's rife, and even if you have a job, the average wage of $50 a month is hardly enough to buy bread. Andranik Arakelian is 12 years old. He's been coming to Oran for 2 years.
I have one brother and one sister, and my sister is disabled. I was selling flowers on the street because we couldn't afford to buy bread. My dad used to work at a factory, and then he became a caretaker at a school. But then he lost his job, and my mum doesn't work either. No one can find work anymore.
I would say it's a phenomenon within the last 5-6 years. You would never see children begging on the street during the Soviet period or even the first years of independence. It's really a question of social difficulty where it's a question of survival. You know, if they're not on the street, they have no food to eat. It's not that they like being there. No mother likes seeing a child begging on the street. And some of the mothers are very educated and just find themselves in a dire situation. Any one of us could have been in their situation.
Many of the children at the refuge have been abandoned by one or both their parents. Nune Ashurian, a slight girl with long dark hair, is 14.
My father left us 6 years ago. We went to visit him in Russia, me and my brother and my mother. But when we got there, we found out that he was getting married again, starting a new life and a new family. And so we came back to Armenia.
I'm not so much angry as saddened by the fact, because as Armenians, we have been raised to think Armenian as a big family. All Armenians are part of a big family. And it aches my heart to see children out on the street. It aches my heart when we become so used to the fact that we can just pass by a child and not notice a child begging on the street. It hurts me to see that the government has not adopted proper regulations and laws and has not provided support for these families.
The children I spoke to at Oran said they wanted to be teachers and doctors when they grow up, all except Artur, who wants to join a traditional Armenian folk band.
We will take another 50. We can afford to take another 50 now. And as people hear about it and as we have more and more sponsors, we will be able to open up many orans, and not just feed the children and teach them and educate them, but to work with the parents and to provide jobs for the families as well.
Amina says her dream is to open many more branches of Oran across Armenia. Thousands of children still live on the streets, but for the 50 who found Amina, their lives have changed immeasurably.
If they ever take Oran away, I don't know how I will survive. I hope one day, when I get a job in my own place, I'll be able to show my gratitude to Mrs. Amani.
That report from Chloe Arnold in Yerevan. And I'm Helen Sini in Cologne. You're listening to Inside Europe. On stage, waving their batons around and ordering musicians into line behind sheets of music. But there's much more to the job of a conductor than meets the eye. Many young, aspiring conductors from around the world travel to the International Bach Academy in Stuttgart, Germany, just to spend a week or two in classes with the renowned conductor Helmut Rilling. After a lifetime of working with famous international orchestras, Helmut Rilling now spends much of his time passing on his skills and his passion for music to young conductors. Jeff Roderida reports on how you learn the art of conducting Helmut Rilling style.
The International Bach Academy in Stuttgart organises two major festivals every year, the Bach Week in February or March, and the European Music Festival in August-September. An important component of each festival is the teaching and training of singers, musicians and conductors from all over the world. A group of around 10 young conductors will spend 2 or sometimes 4 weeks under the tutelage of conductor Helmut Rilling.
I think there are two facets which are very important for a conductor. One is to be clear in the way you conduct, that is to convey the rhythm and the architecture of the music to the musicians. You have to be clear. This is technique of conducting. But of course, this is not the only thing. On the other side, you have to convey also the spirit of the music to your ensemble, to the musicians of the orchestra, to the members of the choir. And both things together make a good conductor.
Helmut Rilling says the greatest challenge for many young, aspiring conductors is communicating confidently with a large number of musicians and singers.
It is very important that you teach conductors not only to conduct themselves, but to communicate with the people which they have in front of them. How to treat the musicians, how to talk to them, what kind of language to you use. You see, I grew up in a time where the type of the authoritarian conductor was still very much in fashion. That is, he was the grand maestro, and when he said a word, everybody else was in awe. This is not the ideal thing, because what you need is that the people which you are conducting are convinced that what you are doing is right, and could be also their opinion. So if you convince them and have a communication with them, then you are a good conductor.
The young Brazilian conductor, Monica Vasquez, returned recently to Stuttgart to participate in her third Bach Academy course.
Und man lernt jedes Mal unglaublich viel.
Every time I come here, I learn so much. What's really good about these courses with Helmut Rilling is that you not only learn theoretically, but you can immediately put into practice what you've learned. You're given a piece of music as part of the festival program, with a full choir, an orchestra, and professional singers at your disposal. And you have to conduct this ensemble in front of a paying audience. That's important, that the theory you're learning is put straight into practice.
Das ist sehr wichtig, ne? Dass der Kurs nicht nur theoretisch ist, sondern dass man also gleich in die Praxis geht.
As part of her course, Monica Vasquez and her fellow trainee conductors are each given an excerpt from Verdi's Requiem to conduct. During rehearsals, there's much stopping and starting and repetition as the young conductors consult with Helmut Rilling.
312.
What are some of the classic mistakes that young conductors, young learning conductors make?
Well, very often you see that the emotion is too strong, especially in rehearsals. You see, in a rehearsal you have to be sober. You have to see where the problems are, what you have to do for getting everybody together, for have a common ground. And very often young people are wild and want to do beautiful expressive things and make too many technical mistakes.
Aspiring Israeli conductor Tamir Chasson says a major difficulty in rehearsals is achieving the right blend and balance between orchestra and choir.
I think what I've learned most from Maestro Rilling is his astonishing way of melting people into one voice after in such a small period of time. It is really his direct approach to the music and to human beings that makes it so psychologically feasible to create music on such a level, and I think that's the greatest lesson one can get. Mr. Rilling's approach to teaching is very creative and constructive because he does not so much criticize, rather he will approach the student in his own body language, which is so important. So many people would say, no, this is wrong, and he does not say that. He said, this is good, but maybe you can do it that way.
Helmut Rilling says he can see the difficulties his students often face in translating conducting theory into practice on stage.
You see, for a conductor, it's not easy to behave naturally in front of many people. And you must get him, a student, the feeling that he should be at ease. And maybe you would not correct all mistakes in front of the ensemble. You would wait and tell him later. But get him the feeling that he is doing a good job and that the people playing enjoy what he is doing and like him. This is important. This frees him, eases him up and makes him doing better music.
Helmut Rilling's student conductors describe their work as being akin to that of a traffic controller or of a captain of a ship. But they also know that conducting involves much more than just technical direction. After several weeks of instruction and practice in Stuttgart, they're better prepared to face the challenge of turning their conductor's baton into something of a magic wand. Jeff Roderita, DW Radio, Stuttgart.
And that's it for today. The program was produced with help from Barbara Gruber, studio manager Lucas Alpert, and sound engineer Doris Meyer. I'm Helen Sini. Thanks for joining me. Inside Europe comes to you from Deutsche Welle Radio in Cologne.
You're listening to CBC Radio Overnight. I'm Judy Madryn. The program you just heard was from Radio Deutsche Welle. If you'd like to comment on this program, write to Deutsche Welle, English Service, 50588, Cologne, Germany. This is CBC Radio 1.